Welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Jean-Martin Fortier, the author of The Market Gardener and a Canadian small-scale farmer. During the conversation today, we discuss how he came to farming, his on-farm practices, how small is profitable, and the importance of standardization and simple practices, such as the use of hand tools and good design before beginning. Together, he, his wife, and two farm assistants raised and sold over $140,000 in produce during the last growing season, with a net profit of $70,000 for he and his family, all on under 2 acres of intensively managed garden beds. Here is a model for anyone who wants to farm with just a little land and how you might find success. If you enjoy this interview with Jean-Martin or any other in the archives, support the show by making an ongoing monthly contribution. Find out how at www.thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to Jean-Martin. I'll join you again afterwards with some thoughts and updates.
Then, Mr. Fortier, if you're ready, if you could give us a bit of your background biography and how it is that you came to do what you're doing.
Yeah, well, I didn't grow up on a farm, and I've been farming for almost 15 years now with my wife, and both of us didn't grow up on a farm or was living, you know, an agrarian lifestyle. And we graduated from McGill University in 2000, and after that, we studied ecology and environment, and that's where we met. And we wanted to somehow make a difference in the world, and we wanted to have a livelihood that was in line with our ideals, and we didn't really know what that could be or would be. And so we ended up traveling around, and we went to Mexico and stayed there and worked for fair trade coffee farms. And then we migrated up north to the United States, because we're from Canada, and we ended up landing in New Mexico, northern New Mexico. They called it the land of entrapment. And we stayed there for 2 years, and we built earthships. And among other things that we did was to start and work on a small organic farm. And that was really a big eye and heart opener for us. And we've been hooked on farming ever since.
What was it about farming that drew you to want to grow food?
Well, you know, I guess it was, it's funny how life is sometimes. You meet people that inspire you. And for us, when we went to northern New Mexico, we were around Santa Fe, beautiful area. And the first farm where we worked, the guy was a French Canadian that had been farming there for a long time. And he was a local hero. And everybody in Santa Fe that would attend the farmer's market would really appreciate his work, and they would line up at his booth to get his salad. And since he was French-Canadian, you know, speaking French was something that was he was excited about. So we shared a lot together, the times that we spent on his farm. And for us, it was just discovering this lifestyle and this agrarian way of living. And he was outside in a beautiful area, beautiful light. He was growing food. He was having fun doing it. And then he would bring his produce to the market, and then people, like I said, they would just line up and thank him for his work. And a story I often say is that, you know, I was doing the cash register at the market for him, and I was seeing all the money he was making. I was like, wow, you know, this is great stuff. And then this guy, Richard, he would leave for a month or two to go to Mexico in the winters. And both my wife, Madeleine, and I, we were like, wow, this is a great setup. And by then, we were understanding more how, you know, this is all about farming. You know, local farming is about applied ecology and about, you know, just living outside of the globalized market system, because, you know, we're growing crops and we're selling them directly. And for us back then, all of this kind of made a lot of sense philosophically, and plus, we had fun doing it. So after 2 years there, we also worked on another farm in New Mexico as farm managers. A funny turn of events. It was a Montessori school, and these guys would hire a farm manager, and the guy that was there left in the middle of the season. So they asked us, and we didn't have a lot of experience, but then there we were managing a 2-acre farm, And we learned a lot there, and it was a great farming community and really inspiring people and stuff. And so we came back to Quebec and started our own thing on rented land. And we rented about a fifth of an acre, set up a summer camp, lived in a teepee, and just started to have a big garden, farming it with hand tools, and we would bring it to a farmer's market. And that was really the start of our story. And from there, we went to, you know, feeding 30 families, to the next year feeding 50 families. And then we moved to another place where we bought a farm. And then we went to feeding 80 families, 100, 150, 200, 250. And the story goes on, and always on a small land base.
That was my next question, is with how many families you're feeding now, having bought a farm, how many acres are you farming to feed those people?
When we were on rented land, at one point these guys sold the place where we were at, and so we needed to move, and land is expensive where we are because we're an hour south of Montreal, and it's a beautiful area. It's called the Eastern Townships, and there's a lot of, you know, bankers and lawyers and all these doctors that want second homes, so they buy these Fermet, these, you know, these little farms here, so they're quite expensive. And we found this 10-acre property that had a rabbit farm. It was a rabbit farm, and it was a 40 by 100 building, and we thought, you know, that would be great to build a house inside of there. And that's what we did. We ended up buying this 10-acre property, but it only had 2 acres of prairie. And so that became the land constraint that we've had ever since. And we've been growing on that 2 acre. We had to manage that 2 acre, and it ended up being that we've designed the farm so that it's 1.5 acres of permanent raised beds, all standardized to the same length. And we have 181 of them. So we've been farming on that acre and a half since 2005. And we've been having ever increasing production. Like I said, we just increased production over the year. And now we're feeding, our CSA adds up when we calculate off the farmer's market. It's 140 CSA and 2 farmer's market. And last year we sold for $140,000 worth of produce that we're growing on that 1.5 acres. So it's really a lot of production for a small land base.
That is quite a return on the work that you're doing for the land base versus the amount of people that you're supporting and how much you're able to sell out of that space. Do you have an idea approximately how many pounds of produce that is off of your farm?
No, that's a very good question. And people ask this a lot, and we've never really measured this because we calculate our production on sales because we can measure that easily. We know what we're bringing to market, and we know the cost. And, you know, when you start comparing farming systems, that's pretty much how people go about it. If you talk about CSA, community supported agriculture, you're going to pretty much measure your farm by the amount of baskets, CSA baskets, or families that you're feeding. I've been told this also. When I talk about feeding families, I need to make sure that I specifically precise that we're providing these families that are partners in our farm with weekly deliveries of freshly harvested vegetables. So it's not a complete diet. We're family farmers, and we're growing vegetables here, and we're providing these families with all of their needs vegetable-wise. So that's really what we do.
Yours is a produce CSA as opposed to a whole diet.
Yeah, because we're on 1.5 acres and we don't have animals, and it's really what it is. It's a market garden. It's a big garden, and we're bringing everything that we grow to market. And yeah, it's really simple in concept.
With your 181 permanent raised beds, what size are those? You say they're all standard.
Yeah, they're standardized and in width, 30 inch, because all of the tools that have been developed in the last 15 years, they've been kind of oriented towards these bed widths. And growing in beds is really the way to go for many different reasons, but the fact that they're permanent makes it so that we don't need a tractor, because the beds are always, you know, they don't need to be plowed and tilled and raised and shaped every year, because we did that once and now we're just kind of cultivating the surface of the beds. And so their width and their length, we're also, we've standardized also their length. They're all 100 foot long because that makes it so that all the material that we use, row covers, insect nettings, the irrigation lines, drip irrigations, they're all 100 foot long, meaning that you need less of them and you're not fooling around looking for, you know, the row cover that's the right length and wasting time because it's all the same thing. And on the farm, the bed then became a unit of measure because when we talk about inputs, let's say, you know, compost, it's going to be, you know, how much tons per acre, but that doesn't really say anything to anybody. But if I tell you, you know, four-wheel barrels per bed, that's a lot easier to understand. And the whole design of the farm, that's where permaculture really went in. And it was interesting because before we even shoveled the first permanent bed, we had laid out a pretty nice map of what we wanted to do. And we wanted to have all these beds. We knew that we would have, you know, about 180 beds, but it's kind of not that easy to manage all of these beds. So we put them together in field blocks, and then we have 10 field blocks of 16 beds, and plus the beds that are in our greenhouses. And at that point, you know, we were looking at minimizing foot traffic. We had a map, and we were kind of designing where everything would go on the farm to make it really, you try to create synergies and try to make it really, really efficient. And foot circulation was what we were really looking at. And we spent the whole winter kind of designing the farm before we even started to build it.
That was where I liked your book when I got the opportunity to sit down and read through it, is that I found it complemented Peter Bain's Permaculture Handbook very well because of many of his ideas of integration combined with what you've included with on-the-ground information about building and growing a market garden-style farm.
I think that's really important that I precise this when I talk about our work and the book I wrote, is that, you know, for us, when I was starting out, you know, permaculture was this amazing school of thought because I was reading all these, you know, Bill Mollison's big book. For me, it was learning how to conceptualize a farming system and to understand all the elements that are working. And then if you look at, you know, Bill Mollison's book, and I don't know that other author that you mentioned, but, you know, because I was really, really deep in permaculture perhaps 15 years ago, 10 years ago, but it was just, he had these maps and it was about thinking your stuff through to make sure that you're really either productive, efficient, or you would do this without putting a lot of input in. And what we're doing on the farm is not really that, because we are a production farm and we need to have two salaries, you know, both Modelin and I, that's our sole income, is the revenue that we generate from selling vegetables. So it's kind of a different thing than a pure permaculture farm design. But we took so many great ideas and ways of looking at our farm from permaculture that for me it just feels like a natural kind of, I have a special connection to permaculture in that way. I feel that my farm's success is linked to what I was understanding from permaculture.
And I have a copy of your book in front of me as we're having this conversation, and was able to find the map of your farm and the layout, and that you have, you know, your permanent raspberries, your beehives, your orchard, your pond. Looking at this, that you have two compost piles that kind of divides the farm along a north-south line, so you have equal access from the east or west as you need to move things. The way that everything's organized, it also looks like your water lines are detailed on here as well, and how those break out to the different areas. And it's incredible to me looking at this picture, knowing that this is only an acre and a half.
Yeah. It'd be wonderful if we could have a picture of how it is from above, like an airplane picture, or because it's really the drawing that is in the book is really how the farm is. And because we did that drawing and we really spent a lot of time thinking about it, making sure that, you know, you're talking about that compost pile and having two of them because, you know, spreading compost into the garden is you're hauling, you know, wheelbarrows of compost. And if your compost pile is like far away, then you're losing a lot of time going to the other side of the garden. So we have two of them. And the same thing, if you look at the drawing, the building, the warehouse, where we wash and store the produce is in the middle of all of our garden. And that was an important setup because when you're doing a market garden, you're basically half of the time you're harvesting. So you're taking produce from the fields and you're bringing them inside the warehouse to condition them. So if your washing station is very far, well, you know, you're losing a lot of time. And when we go harvest with interns, that's usually when it happens most, you know. People forgot to go to the bathroom or they forgot their field knife. And if every time that happens, it implies that you need to walk, you know, 20 minutes to come back and 20 minutes to come over again to the field when you just lost 40 minutes. And, you know, 40 minutes, if this happens three or four times a week, which is usually the case, multiply this by, you know, a year, that ends up being about a week of work. But if you multiply this by 40 years, which is how long we want to be growing on this acre and a half, it's about a year's work that could be lost just because in the initial design, you know, foot traffic and circulation wasn't really accounted for. And on our farm, we thought that was really important. And I got all of that because I was reading these Bill Mollison's book. And thank God.
I look at my own use of the space for my yard, and it's our front yard is our garden. And it happens that the people who owned the house before hung a nail next to the front door. Well, that's where my son hangs his gardening tools. And whenever we go right outside, there they are available for him that he can just pick them up and go directly and begin digging and raking and all of these other things. Now, I just have to follow my son's example and place my things a little bit more appropriately for me.
You need to put them in the center of everything. And so they're always close. And if they're always close, usually what ends up happening also is that you'll store them at the right place. So you won't be looking for them all over the place, which is another important feature.
There's a lot of your book that I like because of how much information you provide and that it has an authentic feel. You're doing this for a living. It's not something where you researched and wrote a book because you had an interest in it. It's because you sat down and wrote a book because this is what you're doing. And that really comes through.
And that was one of my guiding principles in writing this book, because I've wanted to pass along hard information, you know, information that is based on years of trial and success. And so there's a lot of stuff that I don't even talk about in the book because it hasn't been long enough that we've been trying out these, either their new tools or different, you know, techniques that we're doing experiments with. Because the goal of the book, and that was the reason why I took some time took almost a year and a half to sit down and write it, was because we really need more farmers, because we need to move, you know, production, food system production to a local base. And if this is going to happen, if you think this through, well, there needs to be more people growing food. And I've met so many people because I've worked as a mentor before on other farms, and I've visited a lot of young people starting their operation. And most of them don't really know how to go about it because they're picking and choosing different things from different farms that they've worked on or different books that they've read. But the thing is that if you want to be successful in market farming, you need to understand that the farm is a system, and all of the tools that you use, they need to be linked and connected in the techniques and the features, and it's all like this process that needs to be understood as a whole. And I thought that, you know, the way we're farming here, which is pretty different because we don't have a tractor and we're farming with hand tools, and we've been using these techniques that are not very well known. And I thought there was a lot of informal and useful information to share, but my goal was really for the reader to have a wide scope of everything that it implies to be growing commercially. And hopefully the goal is that when people do this, then perhaps they'll be better prepared to do farming, or if they already are, they'll catch good advice to become better growers. That was really the goal of the book.
One of the things that I really like about your book is how practical the information is. Looking on page 94 right now, you have a transplant table for a variety of vegetables. What size of a flat you need for the number of cells that are in it, the number of flats that you're going to need per bed, assuming that it's one of your 30-inch by 100-foot beds, how long they're going to need to stay there, the number of rows you plant, how far they're spaced. This is a lot of the information that, for me, coming in and wanting to do this kind of intensive gardening is the hard information to find or to develop if you don't know someone who's doing this kind of work.
Scott, I really wish I had a book like this when I started out, because that would have saved me many years of figuring this out. But that's exactly what it is if you read that chapter, you know, starting your seedlings or direct seeding, the fundamental part in the book is all these charts that give you the information that is really essential. Because that's the funny thing with farming, you know, growing vegetables. You just get one shot at it every year. There's one spring. And so if you do experiments all the time, then it's just from leading from one year to the other, you know, it's transplanting, I don't know, let's say peppers. Well, you're transplanting peppers in May. Well, that's one shot. And so if you can have a veteran grower that has, you know, hard information that is also successful information, then and you can follow from there and then make some little adjustments, but at least you have a core set of values that you can apply to your farming practices and have results. Yeah, I'm glad you noticed that, because that is the important aspect of the book. There's a lot of technical detail that is, when you just glance it, you don't really think about it, but if you look at the graph and the chart, there's another one, it's yields, all the yields for all the vegetables with intensive spacing. You know, it took us many years. It took us about 4 years to calculate that.
I like charts and tables when presenting information, so it is one of the things that really attracted me when I was looking through this, is all these references that are available. Every couple of pages, I find something else, like you have solutions to fighting insect pests, which you have your preferred solutions and others that are also effective for a variety of things, from aphids through to slugs and midges. It's incredibly practical to me for someone who wants to do this kind of work and get started.
I tried to left out the blah blah. There's so many people doing that I just thought, for me, I'll try to cut out and go to the essential, which is what I think someone needs to know if they're going to be doing this and be successful at it. And for all the information outside of my view about this, there's a lot of other books out there that can, you know, discuss ideas and more lengthy matters. But for me, it was about getting to the point and trying to also explain why and how this works.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
And that's where, when I look for books to recommend to people that they check out, I like two different sources for material. I really like to find one that has theory with some practicality to it. You know, your big idea book with some of the things that you could then implement. And then ones such as your own, where it's a lot about the practical side of that. You get two different voices that lead to one kind of a cohesive picture. And I'm elated to see more material like this coming onto the market, being available to people who want to do this kind of work. Because as you said, we need more people growing food and being farmers. And as a permaculture practitioner, there's a lot of back of the envelope kind of calculations that have been done about how much land you need to feed people year round, a whole diet, and many other pieces in order to answer that question about feeding the world. And I think we can do it. It's just that we have to get there, and it takes a bit of a shift.
Yeah, and you know what? When we're measuring and thinking about these concepts about, you know, how much space you need to feed either, perhaps not the world, but the communities, and you can do it two ways. You can go on a theoretical framework and make some calculus around, you know, specific information, or you could go and see somebody that is actually doing it and take his numbers. And, you know, somehow I feel that both are valid, but there's, when somebody's actually doing it, I think there's a lot of merit to it, because there's a lot of things that needs to be debunked, and that numbers and ideas, they don't always translate perfectly to what is going to happen in reality.
And that's another side of what you are presenting, is the diversity of what you're growing on the farm. And when I look through your crop notes in the appendix that you have, you know, arugula, beans, beets, broccoli, carrots, cauliflower, and on, that present a variety of things that people can raise in different environments, because you have ones that are cold hardy, but also the pictographs that you use to explain which ones have a high market value, ones that are easy to grow, ones that are cold tolerant.
Yeah, because these are there because when you want to be growing, like we grow 50 vegetables on the farm, and it's easier said than done. And each vegetable has his own set of characters, and it's like his, you need to learn, you know, the insects for all of these guys that can be a problem, you know, fertilizing for all of them, you know, harvesting. There's so much information, there's so much, you know, things that you need to learn for all of them. Then that's why I label them as some is easier than others, because if you want to be doing this, it might be a good idea to start with perhaps 10, 15, 20, and then as you master how to grow certain ones good, then you can add some more to your adventure. And so it's just a cast of characters, all of these vegetables, but it's great growing them. I like all of them.
Do you and your wife and children eat a lot of your meals from the food that you grow?
That's one thing that, you know, because we've been doing this for a long time and we've really put a lot of effort into growing, you know, the most amazing quality of vegetable that we know how to. We became really fussy about what we eat. And so we do only almost eat the vegetables that we grow. And that implies that when I go elsewhere, when I want to go out and leave the farm and go to the restaurant and just have a good time, I'm always very disappointed or fussy, or I end up usually ordering everything but vegetables, please, on my plate. And yes, we do have all of our diet come from the farm with regards to vegetables, but also because we do markets. We trade for meat and we trade for eggs and we have two goats also, so we have our own milk, but we end up trading for so many, you know, other produce that we eat locally and in season just because that's what we do. It's great. And, you know, we eat like kings, and I think that that's one of the fundamental part of our farm. Also for the crew, the crew is four people full-time on the farm, and we have also interns that come and visit. So we always take meal times together at noon. And we cook up a good meal, and we just appreciate it a lot. That's what it's all about. This is the good food revolution. I'm happy to be part of it.
Your mention of four people full-time, I have some questions about your operations. And when you say four people full-time, is that you and your wife are two of those?
Yeah, and full-time going from March to December. Because we live in, you know, we're in Quebec here, so it's pretty brutal in the winter. So we don't grow in December, January, and February. And so there, it's me and my wife. We've been doing this, you know, without outside work for more than a decade. And we hire one full-time for the whole season, so from March to December, and one other person part-time for the harvest. And so there's usually four or five of us, because we also have some interns that come in and come out, but I don't count them as work because they're wonderful and we like them and we like sharing and passing on what we're doing, but they're not that reliable. Some of them have read my book was translated into French before, written in French and then translated into English, and they've read it and they've really enjoyed it and feel connected by it. And so they write us these long letters and they want to come to the farm and they just want to learn, and then they're excited, so we answer back and say, okay, you have a spot, you can be with us 4 weeks from then to then. And then they call us the night before and they say, you know what, I just met this cool guy and I'm going biking for the summer. That happens so often that we don't rely on them anymore. If they're there, that's wonderful. And if they're not, the four of us, we can manage, and it's actually faster when there's nobody else that's kind of asking questions, and we just roll down what we have to do. And the other thing that's great about small-scale farming is that it's never boring because we're always changing jobs. You know, we do something for an hour, and then we're moving on because the job is finished, because the farm is not big. You're not, like, harvesting, you know, peas for, like, 7 hours because that's not what we do. We have a little bit of peas, a little bit of carrots, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and we all bring that to market. And since there's, you know, no middleman, well, we don't need to be producing volumes. We make a good markup, you know, 100% markup on everything that we sell. And we sell out pretty much of everything because we do top quality and people know us and they appreciate our work. And
so then with that markup, you're out of the 140,000 that you sold in produce, and about 70,000 of that was your net profit?
Yeah, the margins have been around from 40 to 50% ever since we started the farm in 2005, meaning that once we've paid the employees and the expenditures, you know, mortgage, electricity, seeds, pretty much everything, almost half of the gross sales come back to us as our salaries, which is not that much if you compare to what actors and lawyers and bankers are doing. But if you compare to other trades, carpenter or, you know, beekeeper, or it's pretty good. And the three main reasons are that we don't rely on hired labor for most of the work. And, you know, on most vegetable farms, you know, organic vegetable farms selling directly to market and CSAs and whatever, half of their expenditures is labor because it's expensive to hire people, especially if you want to give them a good wage. And so we've understood this from the start, and we've always thought, no, we want to keep the farm small because we don't want to have that big expense. And so hiring one or one and a half person is not, it's not a big expense at all. So the labor is me and my wife. And the other part is that we are farming with hand tools, and all the equipment that we bought to start the farm ended up costing us around $40,000. So that was a pretty small investment, considering that we've been using these tools for more than 10 years and they've been paid off, you know, a long time ago. So our overheads are also very low. And so if you add these two together with the fact that you have 100% markup on what you sell, then it ends up working really well. So that's why I say, you know, small is profitable, and it really is. It's just about learning how to do this right and having the right setup. And then you just produce and sell, and you're building clientele, and you're creating resiliency in the community with food production, and you're creating jobs. And we should multiply these kind of small farms. Instead of having mass production, we should have production by the masses. And it's just, that's my whole view on this. I get excited about talking about this. You can feel it.
This is exactly the kind of piece of the food production question that I'm trying to get a handle on because, well, as I joke, and my listeners have heard this quite a lot, my wife and I are kind of crap gardeners. My running joke is that we can grow strawberries, garlic, children, and cats. Otherwise, when it comes to food production, it's not that good, but we know plenty of small-scale farmers who are doing or trying to do good work. And when you talk about profit, one of my past guests is actually one of my family members, Wayne Herring, and he started a small-scale farm raising chickens and pigs right now. And in that conversation, you know, his idea is that he would like somebody to be able to make $30 an hour gross for the work that they do as a farmer. And he broke down those numbers for us, and the amount of money that he has to make per pound of meat in order to pay someone that rate based on their labor is a very small percentage relative to the other inputs for raising a chicken.
Yeah, I don't know that much about animals because I've never really given it a shot. But, you know, everybody knows Joel Salatin. And it's kind of like, I know that some people are not convinced about what I'm going to say here, but farming is a trade. And if you want to be good at it, you need to know how to do things in the proper scheme of things. It's like, you know, a baker cannot improvise how to make bread all the time. he needs to follow a recipe, he needs to follow procedures, he needs to have a chain of operations so that it's efficient. And, you know, all of this should and can apply to small-scale farming. Again, it's just about, I know there's a lot of money in organic production because, you know, the supermarkets are full. Whole Foods are making a killing because they're selling. It's just about learning how to produce perhaps better. And it's just then from then, if you're selling and you're doing well, if you're doing quality. We've been always looking on the farm how to lower our expenses every year. And we take a lot of time to go through all of our expenses and wonder, okay, how can this be trimmed or do differently? And we've really been trying to optimize everything that we do on the farm. I think that's one key to successful farming is optimization of the operations. And that's how also we have a life. Because since we're really efficient in most of our labor and our jobs in everything that we do, we can finish the workday at 5 o'clock and go get our kids and just go biking and have this life. Because farming is great, but there's other stuff also that's great in life, you know?
You've really found a way to develop a work-life balance as a farmer.
I think so. I think that was our goal ever since we've started. And that was the reason why we ended up, you know, figuring how to do it. Because when, like I said, you know, the story at first, our first role model was somebody that was enjoying this and that was taking time off in the winter. And that was, you know, he wasn't the perfect farmer. He had probably problems and whatever, but he was hardly enjoying all of this. So that was our goal. And we want to travel every winter and we want to bring our kids to visit other cultures and to have them exposed to not only farming realities, but city life and other stuff. And so we plan for this to happen. And we still do this every year. When we finish the season, we take a break. And then when we're ready to start again, we sit down and we look at our mission statement, our objectives. And sometimes the objective is not about, you know, growing more. It's just about taking piano lessons and doing other stuff, because the other stuff is also part of the equation. We need to balance all this. So we plan for it. And I could talk for hours about how I think this is important, but I'll just let it go.
For my listeners who have been with me for a while, as we are recording this in April, though it won't come out for a while, I recently went through a bit of a crossroads with the work that I'm doing because of my life falling out of balance. So I can really appreciate that. And it's one of the pieces where I had to step away from a lot of what I was doing in order to kind of reset and go, okay, what really matters to me? And what is it that I need to take care of that isn't about the material? What are these other pieces that bring me joy in life in order to make these other pieces work?
I sure hope that you are finding balance and you are thriving because of it.
It's getting there, and it's interesting to see that happen, that letting go of some of these other pieces has provided new opportunity.
Yeah, it has, and it still is, because, you know, let's change the clock here and say now I've written a book, and my book in French was an instant bestseller, and in France it's really huge, and in Belgium and in Canada and now in the U.S., because a lot of people, they want to start the farm. And so I provide a role model, successful role model, and I provide useful information. So to say that it's getting quite popular and I'm getting all these offers and all these people want to get me to do all of these things and it's all exciting, but you know, I want to farm because that's what I chose and that's what I like. And I want to be with my kids and my wife and I want to travel in the winter. And so, you know, I've had to say no to a lot of cool stuff and I'm proud of this because I know that the importance is my family, my CSA members, the people that we feed that have been supporting us for so many years. And that's why I wrote a book. It's in the book. Just read the book and from there, do your own stuff and hopefully it'll work out. And I don't feel that I need to be preaching about all of this. I'm happy to talk about it, but each his own.
So that I don't take up too much more of your time, I have four more questions that I wrote down before we bring this to a close. Shall we walk through those, and then I'll let you return to your day. When you mentioned your hand tools, what hand tools would you recommend for someone who's just starting out?
There's no one more than another. They're all linked in a system. And I've just been asked to try and do six of them, which was, it took me a long time. I wrote a blog about that. But it's like, you know, which part of your car do you think makes it run best? It's kind of hard because they're all, you know, if you take the engine out, then it's just the whole other thing doesn't work. But I guess, you know, I would say the walking tractor. So we grow without a tractor, but we use a two-wheel tractor, you know, BCS, kind of like these motorized, bigger, what people call rotor tillers. But it's not a rotor tiller because you can change the tool in the back and you can put, you know, harrows, you can put mulching devices, you can put, you know, generators, whatever. And so these walking tractor, that's one of the one fundamental tool for us to be growing on such an intensive pace. Then I would say probably hoes, the right hoe for the right job. And we have different ones. And people, they can all look at these tools on themarketgardener.com. There's a list and pictures of all these tools. And so that's one. And then tarps. We use tarps on the farm to weed out the garden. And it's wonderful because these black UV-treated silage tarps, we leave them on the permanent beds. And what that does is that the tarp makes the soil warmer underneath it. It's also more humid because it retains humidity, and it's dark. So these are the perfect germinating conditions. And what happens is that all the weed seeds that are in the ground, they germinate. And then there's no light, so they die. So by putting the tarps like this, you're actually weeding the gardens and taking out weed seeds that would have popped up in your vegetable plants. And so we use a lot of these tarps, and that's how we prepare beds also, because when you remove that tarp, you know, it's clean. And then you can just go with a broad fork, which is another tool that I really like. A broad fork is a U-shaped lever tool that really opens the soil. So for deep tillage, gentle tillage, that doesn't harm the structure, that doesn't bring up weed seeds from the bottom, that's another tool. So we put tarps, and then we go with a broad fork, and then we use our walk behind tractor to prepare the seed beds. And then we use some precision seeders that make it go 2 million times faster to seed in the ground, because we used to do this by hand when we started. So there's different precision seeders that we like and use. And then we go with the hose and to keep the bed clean for cultivating weeds. And so it's kind of hard for me to pick and choose.
It's that idea of a right tool for the right job.
That's what it is. Most of the tools that we use on a farm, people, they haven't heard about them. You can't find them in a hardware store. They're either imported from Europe or sold in specialized gardening market farming catalogs like Johnny's Selected Seeds. These guys from Maine pretty much developed all the tools that we're using on our farm. And again, if people want to know what these tools are, they can visit the website, themarketgardener.com, and then they'll see the picture of the tool and where they can get it, because they're not available everywhere. But they're good tools that are specialized for intensive market gardening production.
And I'll make sure to include a link back to your website and that information so people can get to it. From there, when we're talking about market gardening and someone getting started, from your own experiences, were you profitable in your first year, or did you have to prepare in case you weren't when you were launching your farm?
We've always been profitable every year, even when I was renting, because we've always kept our expenses pretty low. When we bought the farm, we had to borrow money. So we had to have a mortgage. And in our mortgage, we included more money to buy more equipment that we needed. And we did also get a grant. So that made it so that we didn't have to pay up front for everything that we needed, all the investments that we needed to make the farm happen. And so we basically had a business plan, and we had calculated that, you know, if we borrow $60,000 to buy all the equipment and do the field work and style drainage tiles and build cold rooms and everything that we needed to happen, then that would end up costing us around 10 grand or, you know, from, I think it was seven grand a year for 10 years, which we calculated that was good enough for us to still be very profitable. And it's an expenditure. And so I think that's, you know, people, they always talk about not having debt. But I think you need, if you're going to be in business, you need to calculate that, because giving all your money up front sometimes is not the most effective way of going into business. I think all the people in the alternative movement, they should, I think, this is my own opinion, and I don't judge anybody on that, but they should start, and instead of trying to just kind of feel disgust and remove from all of the, you know, bad practices that are out there, it would be perhaps to have a goal of what we really want to achieve, something that's sustainable, that's, you know, resilient, artisanal, biological, and then try and see what these guys are doing that works and try and pick up some of that stuff, because not everything is bad or, you know, gray or black or white. And, you know, bankers, if they're good at it, they can give you good advice about how to manage your money. Anyway, perhaps we shouldn't talk about this.
We can leave that where it is.
It's pretty rare that I vouch for bankers, but it's just, from my experience, we've had help by these people that were pretty good in setting up the financial setup for our small organic farm. And it just changed my perspective on that over the years, you know.
In my work, I was able to find people who were, even if they didn't necessarily understand what I was doing, they cared about me and my work enough to help me make good decisions and essentially through their actions invest in what it was that I was doing.
Yeah, I think our CSA partners, that's what they've been doing with us ever since, because when you're a CSA member, well, they pay us up front at the start of the season. And that really is the only reason why we thought we could do this, because we knew that we would get money ahead of time and we didn't have to rely on credit cards to buy everything that we needed, because we do get a big chunk of our income in May or in April before even the first seeds is in the ground. And that's why I feel indebted to them, and that's why I see my role as providing them the most nutritional, top quality produce, because I care for them because they care for me. And we're just in this right relationship. I think this is possible because we're small. And I think that when you grow bigger all the time, I think you will lose this. You know, if your CSA is ever expanding and you want to hire more and more people and just have more and more production, then you perhaps remove yourself from this partnership with individuals. And for me, I'm not saying it's bad, but it's just that the choice that we made was that we wanted to have relationship with our CSA partners and our clients, and we do. That really supports us in our hard work, and it really makes it worthwhile, I think.
And I can speak to that other side as a CSA customer. My wife and I were CSA members with a local organic farm for several years, but then as their operations grew, they started selling to several local grocery stores, and we began noticing that the produce that was being shipped to the grocery store was higher quality than what we were receiving as CSA customers. And that was really, it was saddening to us to go and see all these perfect vegetables, but then when we would pick up our box, they looked like all the seconds, and things were bruised or a little mishandled, and we had been investing in them every year, and yet what we were getting in return didn't seem to be of the same value as what we were giving to the farm.
I totally understand and see how this can happen in farming as you kind of climb the ladders. And this is the kind of thing that I think it's useful to say to your family farmer, you know, because it's feedback and it's how you feel. And then perhaps sometimes this is, you know, it can be brushed away also, but sometimes it could be good to hear it. And then you can reconsider this if you're a farmer and say, okay, am I making the right choices? What am I doing here? And then again, every case perhaps is different, but I've really felt strongly about keeping my CSA members happy and my clients also that I sell at Farmers Market. I want them to be happy too because they've been supporting us forever.
How did you market and grow? Like, how did you find your customer base?
Well, we're lucky because in Quebec, we have this NGO that's called Équitaire. And Équitaire, what they do is that as family farmers, we're all part of this network with them. And they're an umbrella organization. And their role is to promote ecological farming and good food. And they do all the promotion for CSA. And then so there's billboards, there's ads in newspapers. They have contacts for radio shows, whatever, whatnot. And then all the customers that are interested in this kind of way of sourcing their food, they can look up on their website, and then there's maps of all of the drop-off points for the family farmers. And then from then, people subscribe to CSAs. And it's just because they're national and because they have, they're good at it and they have, you know, promotional and marketing people, they just attract a huge crowd. So basically, they're doing pretty much all of the promotion for us when we're looking for new clients. And for bigger farms, this has been really helpful. And when we started, it also was. Now, since we've been, you know, doing this for a long time, all of our clients, they've been with us for 10 years, and we don't need to be promoting a lot. But yeah, at the start of it, that was a good and useful help that we received from a group like that. To all of these people out there that are working to help promote this idea of sourcing locally and organic production, the work that they do, bringing more people to our table, is so vital, so important. You know, I really appreciate all the work that these people do because I think it's really important that there's people that are taking on that role. And in the same breath, I would say, but we also need more people to, you know, put on their rubber boots and start their own farm because we need to have more farmers out there producing food.
The conversation that I had with David Holmgren long ago at this point involved the idea of everyone finding a couple of different niches that they would fill as their areas of expertise. And the more and more that I walk down this road, as I, you know, joked earlier, I'm not a good gardener, but we can sit and have a conversation like this as an interview that then goes out to lots of people in the world so that they can learn more. When it comes to the technology and all this other stuff, that's kind of where I'm at. So helping to support people who want to grow food is part of my process. I do my thing, they do theirs, and we build something that's better. You know, you have this organization that helps you with the marketing and promotion so that you can do what you love, which is to farm.
Yeah, and that's important because it, like in anything, we're building community. And in community, not everybody's doing the same thing. But we're all together on this, on the same page with regards to what our goal and what we want to go towards to. And I think, you know, agriculture, locally sourced and produced, is one of the pillars of where we're heading next. So everybody that's involved in that, I think, should feel really, really proud to be in that whole concept and this whole framework because we are changing agriculture right now. There's more and more young people, not so young people, that are starting farming. There's ever-increasing demand for local, for organic. And, you know, there's a lot of people that are making experiments. They're sharing them. There's a lot of people that are putting the lights on these people so that other people know about them, like you are doing. And, you know, all of this is just creating a movement. And it's an unstoppable movement. We are going somewhere else. It may take some more time, but we are going somewhere else. And it's exciting. I'm never kind of gloom and doom because what I see all around me is just more interesting stuff happening. Perhaps because my lens are like that, but I think it's moving and it's growing and really positive, all that's happening. And I think permaculture has a lot to do with this because it kind of framed everything in a new conceptualized way where things are positive and pragmatic and especially intelligent, you know? There's a lot of intelligence in permaculture. And I think this is important also because you can be super motivated and super, you know, good heart and work hard, but you need to also kind of like have a system and a good design, and all of that is really important if you want to be farming.
One of the thoughts that I keep returning to right now in the place where I'm at as we're recording this is that idea that in order to build a different world, we have to think differently than how we got to this place. I find that permaculture is a large part of that, the framework that it provides us to think within, to see a different way.
Yeah, that's so true. And just yesterday, I was coming back from a Mother Earth News Fair in Asheville, North Carolina. There was about 10,000 people that came to a fair talking about, you know, organic and, you know, the agrarian lifestyle and just this homesteading idea. And it's, wow, there's a lot of people that are interested in this idea. And yesterday, coming back, I got a quote from a book. It came to be my favorite quote, and I'd like to read it to you guys. And it's, "The way to subvert the dominant paradigm is to have more fun than they do, and especially making sure that they know it." And I like that because, you know, farming, the way we do it is fun, and we are having fun doing this. And it's productive, it's profitable, and it's just, we are changing things when we're having a good time doing these alternatives. That's why they work.
Mentioning the Mother Earth News Fair, will you be at the one in Pennsylvania in September?
Unfortunately, I think not, because this is like embedded in my growing season. I will be in Kansas, I think, in late October or November, I don't know. But perhaps next year, if they invite me. I had a great time and it was wonderful, and I'm so happy to share my story and what we're doing, because for a lot of people, they don't know what we're about, and they come down and they hear our story. And, you know, we didn't have a lot of chance to talk together about how we farm is different, but we don't have a tractor, and we're growing crops, you know, really tightly so that we get a living mulch out of the crop that we're growing. It shades out the weeds, and it's just, there's a lot of interesting stuff to.
My last question is, what would your recommendations be to anyone who wants to do this work, who wants to farm?
So this is an easy one for me, and read The Market Gardener. And I'm honest about this, because if I had, like I told you, if I had a book like this when I started out, that would have saved me 5 or 6 years of trying to figuring this all out. And I think that when people read a book like this one, they will have a broadened understanding of all the elements of a production system for vegetables. And that will help them understand things from a more holistic perspective. And then there's a lot of practical, really useful hand-down information. And from then, if you do read the book and appreciate it and like it, then I think the next step, if you're thinking about doing this, is to work on an organic farm for at least one full season. And then, because this is the reality of being outside, rain or shine, cold and hot, your knees in the ground, your fingers kind of touching soil all the time, the hardships, the good times, you know, all that it implies. And then you'll see and feel if you like it or not. And it needs to be one full season for people to really see if they like it. And if they do, I'm pretty sure they'll be hooked on it. And so the next step, I think, is to start your own farm and start it small and just develop. Because when you're doing it for yourself, then you're really learning a lot about it, and you're taking decisions, and you need to think things through. And that's the whole power of starting small and farming with hand tools, that you don't need to be having a big farm for it to be productive and profitable. You can have something small and just build it incrementally as you develop your skill set. So yeah, there's a process to it. You can't just improvise and jump right into it. I think you need to prepare yourself a bit, and that's what I would recommend.
We've covered everything that I had in mind for this first conversation. Is there anything else that you'd like to add for the listeners before we draw this to a close?
Thank you for the time. Thank you for listening. And if you like what you've heard, just pass it along and get the movement to be built up again. And actually, I might wish people just happy gardening and happy season, and hope I'm looking forward now because this is spring has finally arrived where we are, and I just want to jump out and go outside.
Thank you, Jean Martin, Mr. Fortier, for the conversation.
Thank you, Scott. It was a great pleasure. Anytime.
And that was Jean Martin Fortier. In my review of his book and in this interview, I expressed how much I enjoy what it is that he's doing. In particular, this book is one that I wish I'd had when I was first setting up my front yard garden. Combine this with Peter Bain's The Permaculture Handbook, and you have all the makings of a small-scale production permaculture farm that is holistic and integrative, with a Zone 1 vegetable garden that can provide regular and routine income while developing perennial and animal agricultural systems in other areas of a property. On this subject of small-scale farming, I've included links to other interviews from the archives about the life and times of starting and running a farm, including those with Wayne Herring of Herring's Greengrass Farm and my friend Aaron Harvey of the Kale Yard. Give those a listen and have a better understanding of whether or not this life of farming is for you. Along the way, as always, if there's any way that I can assist you in creating the world you want to live in, answer any questions you might have on permaculture, or helped connect you to resources you need, feel free to get in touch. Give me a call, 717-827-6266. Send me an email, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. Or if you'd like, you can write me a letter. The Permaculture Podcast, P.O. Box 16, Dauphin, D-A-U-P-H-I-N, Pennsylvania, 17018. You can also join in the conversations at facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast. Or follow me on Twitter, where I am @PermacultureCST. One last update before I draw this to a close. The show is going on the road in September and October, and I'd like to invite you to join me. September 6th, photographer John and I attend the Finger Lakes Permaculture Tour in and around Ithaca, New York. September 12th through the 14th, we'll be at the Mother Earth News Fair in Seven Springs, Pennsylvania. October 11th, I'll be at ChabaCon in Bridgeton, New Jersey, where Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute is the keynote speaker. And then October 21st, I'll be at the Roanoke Natural Foods Co-op at Grandin Village at 6:30 p.m. for a discussion on permaculture, creating a better world by design. You'll find links for more information about these events in the show notes. All of us have an opportunity in what we do to create a better world, to create the world that we want to live in. Spend each day doing that. And making a difference by taking care of the earth, yourself, and each other.